You're listening to Grocery Journal.
Enjoy the show.
Quick grounding moment. All right.
And we're good.
We're good.
Live from the BC Cannabis Summit in Kelowna, BC, out of the Bougie Lounge, a converted garage in the social media. How does it feel to be in this magical place?
It is very magical to be in this garage. I agree.
It's good vibes. It's a good vibe garage as far as they go.
It's great.
Oh, I got a weird look for saying garage earlier. That's how I natively would say it.
I get it. I wasn't going to comment, but then I did feel the need to say garage.
I kind of like garage. It's a bit more suave.
It feels smoother.
Yeah. Garage is a bit more clunky.
It feels rough.
Oh, go get it out the garage, mate. It's, English through and through, isn't it? So thanks for coming. I heard you speak on a Clubhouse about sustainability, and I was like, whoa, who is this person that's just blown my mind? Really shining a light on the need for sustainability in Canada. So you want to tell me a little bit about yourself and, well, how did you get on this journey of sustainability?
Sure. So I did not anticipate starting my, when I began my career, I did not think this is what I was going to do. I wanted to be a voice actor for audiobooks. Like, that's what my passion was. But I moved to Canada in 2014 and got really, really interested in just like how legalization was right on the cusp. And I started helping some women in their 50s, mostly friends of my mother-in-law, use cannabis, especially from the medical system. They were really struggling with insomnia, arthritis, really common complaints. And they just had no idea how to access information that I felt like was almost common knowledge. So I started helping these women understand anything from titration to like how to make your own suppositories. It's just some coconut oil and ice trays from IKEA. So we can talk about that a separate time if you like. But at the end of the day, I had this really robust understanding of how people were using cannabis and what its many varieties were, as well as the chemical aspects of it as well are not always easy to grasp when we talk about THC and CBD and then the variety of terpenes. And so I got hired by a cannabis pharma company who brought in a bunch of QA people from pharma and J&J, the regulatory people from pharma, and they just had no idea what this plant could be. So I ended up leading all of the commercialization efforts just by virtue of the fact that I was the one that had cannabis knowledge and they had production knowledge. But ultimately what I was doing is saying, this is what the market needs. Here's how we need to price it. Here's what the margin looks like based on the materials. Here's the project plan. Let's negotiate with the boards. Let's get this listed. Let's ship it out. So 60 SKUs is my SKU count to date in terms of like products that I've brought to market. And for a while I was like, man, I love ops. Like, I really want to be in logistics. I don't know how I got from, voice actor to logistics. It feels like a very weird transition.
It's a bit of a leap.
But that was like really sexy to me. It's like figuring out supply chains. I love puzzles. So that felt really good. And I enjoyed doing that for a really long time. I spent about 5 years doing that. But being in ops and also being someone who cares about climate change, I saw a lot of these things in practice in terms of how we were operating and not necessarily things that we were doing badly, but questions we weren't asking ourselves. And so this is how it's always been done, or I see people doing this, so I want to do the same thing, and not thinking about the business holistically as something that operates within an environmental and social context felt like a missed opportunity. And meanwhile, I'm hearing my peers, especially on the bud tending side, feeling like their labor is undervalued and underpaid for, and it's hard for them to make a living. Meanwhile, they're considered essential workers in the pandemic and like servicing the public, and acknowledging and seeing that struggle as a societal need. It made me upset. I harbored a lot of anger around that for a really long time. But I think a lot of that anger was because I was working at this company and I didn't feel like I could act in alignment with my values. So I was like constantly butting heads against that and feeling like this is not what I should be doing. Like, this does not align with my higher purpose. So I started Apical specifically to focus on these environmental and social questions that actually contribute and drive profitability. And that's ultimately, when I talk about sustainability work, which encompasses like a wide scope of things. So I'm just going to use sustainability as a blanket term, but I have to go down specifically into what a lot of these things mean. Where was I going with this? I started sustainability work. I distracted myself. Damn it, Francis.
Well, that was a great opening, and there's a lot to unpack there. Okay. So you said you're from California, right?
Originally, yeah.
Okay. So did you come over to, you're in Toronto now?
Mm-hmm.
Did you come over specifically to take advantage of the fact that Canada was legalizing cannabis?
I didn't. I fell in love. I followed a partner here, my husband. So yeah, he said, let's move to Canada. The summers are really nice. And I really did not question anything beyond that. So he didn't fully disclose what the weather conditions would be when we moved here.
Well, from California, it's a bit of a shame the summers are nice.
I eventually learned how to dress myself. That was the critical.
That's important. So you came over, you got a job with like a pharma company doing cannabis.
Yeah.
60 SKUs, that's an impressive amount.
Yeah, it was a lot.
You enjoyed ops, and look, I always dismissed operations. I thought it was boring. I didn't want to get into it. And then I started a business, and now I rever operations. Like, just makes your life easier. Yes. You know, you save money. It's just so important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've really almost had to learn that the hard way. But getting to a place now where I recognize the importance of it, and I'm putting effort into that. So that's cool. And then things started my business.
Yeah.
You started your business because things were frustrating you about sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
So you said like sustainability, it's quite a broad term.
Yes.
So how would you break that down?
So I'll start by saying that the objection that I hear the most when it comes down to doing this work is sustainability just isn't profitable. And the reason why that sentence bothers me so much is specifically because that is not a specific term. It's like saying cannabis isn't profitable. Well, some companies are not profitable. Some companies are very profitable. So it really depends. And also there's all these ancillary businesses. So like, what does that mean? Cannabis isn't profitable. And so sustainability isn't profitable has no real meaning. So when we talk about sustainability, we can be talking about a variety of things. We can be talking about living soil. We can be talking about our waste management in terms of, you know, biomass recovery, in terms of selling our materials, but also in terms of reusing items. We can be talking about renewable energy. We can be talking about energy that comes from our biomass. We can talk about green buildings. We can talk about concrete and construction. Like, there are so many different aspects to this. So when someone says sustainability isn't profitable, to me, that's like it's almost like a red flag that they don't actually know what that word means or what it could imply, because the second you start to get specific, they're like, oh yeah, I would try that, right? Like LEDs and the lighting in an indoor cannabis facility represents just about 60% of energy consumption of the entire operation. So when you have all of this lighting that's consuming most of the energy, you want the lighting to be as efficient as possible. And LEDs are more efficient. They reduce your energy consumption by 70%. So you're reducing your energy consumption at a time where fuel prices are rising. That is a cost-effective proposition, but you have to be specific with these people, because then they go, oh no, sustainability, that feels like it costs a lot of money. Like,
sure, yeah. And I guess if you're min-maxing with this, you could even say, well, why using LED? We've got a great big burning ball in the sky that can grow cannabis and has done long before electricity was even
absolutely
a thing.
Absolutely.
But then there's a trade-off, because it seems to me, and someone could tell me otherwise, but the best cannabis is often grown indoor where you're controlling everything. And outdoor, it's a little bit of a different kind of beast. So What's your take on that? Do you think that there is a trade-off? And if you're doing your best to grow, at the end of the day, you've got to grow a great product to be profitable and to be successful. Do you think there's like wiggle room within that? Or is it just about kind of trying to min-max everything?
Well, I think everything is trade-offs, but maybe not in the way you mean. So I don't think that we need to trade off profitability for sustainability. But there are different ways to be looking at each of these forms of growing. So like, yes, we do want more controlled indoor growing. And so we'll have outdoor, which is great because we can utilize this big ball of light. We can increase biodiversity. That's amazing. But then you can also have indoor cultivation that's maybe aquaponics, and that addresses different needs, right? We can address food security using aquaponics. We can address chemical fertilizers and their impact on our local environment. We can reduce our dependency on chemical fertilizers. Like, it's got miraculous properties too. So it's not a trade-off between sustainability and profitability. It's like, what are we min-maxing just on the environmental side? Because we're all part of this big system and we're pulling lots of levers. And so ultimately what I think that means is that there's room for both types of these kinds of cultivation facilities, because ultimately both that living soil farm and that aquaponics facility, they can both be carbon neutral, doing completely different things.
Mm. Wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It seems like if you're building a cannabis company from scratch, it's a kind of no-brainer thing to go down the sustainability road and set things up like that. For companies that have been operating for a little while, you know, it is difficult to change. It takes a lot of effort, willpower, money, buy-in from various different stakeholders. What are you seeing when you approach companies? Are they open to this, or are they meeting it with resistance?
I'll tell you what. The people who say to me the things that you've just said, we're too small right now, we can't do it, and oh, we're too big right now, we can't do it, they're actually the same person. And they say the same thing throughout their life cycle. And there are people, many of whom are here at this conference, who know already, and they've never made this excuse because it's important to them. So what I find is, like, there are a lot of forms of capital. So when we talk about Bay Street Capital and sort of the conventional VC route, that mentality brings in this notion that, like, sustainability is not for the beginning and it's not for the middle and it's not for the end, because it's always too hard. And as far as they're concerned, you know, climate action, desertification, these are all externalities. These are all things that are not part of their economic model. And so they're never going to prioritize sustainability.
But you said that sustainability can be profitable.
It can, absolutely. As an example, a waste audit, right? A waste audit is low-hanging fruit for any manufacturing organization. 90% of the materials that we buy to produce the product don't actually get used. Let me rephrase. 90% don't actually get put into their final product. So, like, you have chemical fertilizers, you're not sold chemical fertilizer. It's not part of your final product. 80% of those are reused a single time. And when we buy materials, only 60% of that material value is actually utilized and the rest goes to waste. So when you think about a waste audit, it's actually a way to conserve supplies and pay for less supplies in the long run. Even talking about something as basic as that, right? The second I bring that up, they go, sustainability isn't profitable. I'm like, well, let's be specific. Let's talk about a waste audit. And I start talking about these things. Then they're like, okay, well, that's interesting. Thank you. And the conversation ends. So there, for so many people, there just isn't even a desire to listen to the business case at the end of the day, because they're happy with the way they're doing things.
Mm. Do you think that consumer perceptions are changing towards this?
I think scrutiny is definitely increasing, and that's one of the biggest risks that these organizations face is, you know, a consumer with a cell phone and someone who's doing just a little bit of digging. I don't know if you've ever seen, like, the doxing that sometimes happens on TikTok. Like, someone will say something offensive and then somebody will look through all of their previous posts and find out where this person lives and then call their employer, and that can happen to a company who, you know, 63% of your shoppers will abandon your brand if they feel that you have kept yourself in willful ignorance or you have lied to them. Either of those makes you a greenwasher, and most consumers won't continue to continue purchasing. So you can claim innocence, you can say that you didn't know, but that's not really going to hold any water.
And so you've got all these different stakeholders or players along the supply chain in Canada right now. I guess maybe starts with the government, and they're the ones that created all of this, created the framework and the system. Of course, any product moved through Canada, BC, for example, you know, it's all going through the BCLDB, mm-hmm. government-controlled distribution, gets passed on to the retail stores. Of course, the producers have actually grown the product, sent it to the government, and then we as the end consumers open it up and have a look at it. Who do you think that has the biggest amount of influence or could bring the most impact to the table in terms of helping to improve sustainability?
I don't think it's a single part of the supply chain. I think it is a coalition of everybody throughout the supply chain, because the BCLDB, the OCS, they cannot solve all of these environmental problems. The producers, they cannot solve all of these environmental problems. Neither can the retailers. And for that matter, neither can all the suppliers of all of the materials that we buy to actually make the cannabis product at the end of the day. And so it would require, you know, the BCLDB coming together with the LPs and the retailers, plus, you know, a private entity that maybe does some sort of circular packaging in order to actually implement some sort of process whereby we can tackle packaging waste. So there isn't one single influencer that has the power to do all of these things. There's just not a collaborative working environment. Both producers and retailers are constantly in conflict with these government wholesalers. The government wholesalers have positioned themselves for that. And right now, the relationship between LP and retailer is so transactional, we can't have big coalition building conversations because the dust hasn't settled in the industry yet. So it really takes a lot of like outside influence and people who are trying to bring in all of these connections, even though right now it's hard, to set us up for 2 years down the line when we can actually have all of this come together and implement industry-wide solutions.
So if there's maybe perhaps a quick win that is out there for us to get, what would you say that is that could bring us the biggest overall positive impact with the smallest amount of output or least amount of resistance?
How about zero output? I will, like, in terms of effort. So think about reuse. When you have a piece of packaging, the way that's created is that materials are extracted from a really harmful way from the earth. There's carbon footprint, there's waste associated with that. Then that material gets processed. That process has a high carbon footprint, high degree of waste. Then that product comes to us usually from very far away, that has carbon footprint. Then we have the labor, we put the thing in the package, we label it, and then we give it to the consumer and we expect them to use it only once before it gets disposed of. That's typically the take, make, waste mentality. And so we have all of these resources that are going to a landfill. All of this plastic, think about black plastic. It can't get recycled, mostly because we don't have the infrastructure to do that.
As in just, that's not a technical term, it's just the color black.
Black plastic.
Oh, wow.
The color.
So that has an impact, the color.
It absolutely has
an impact. Oh, wow, I had no idea.
In fact, lower opacity plastics can have a higher rate of material conservation. So actually the Health Canada regulation that everything has to be opaque reduces the recyclability potential of all of our cannabis packaging.
Wow.
So reuse is like, this stuff is literally going to waste. We put all of this effort and time and money throughout the supply chain. So collecting consumer packaging, especially black packaging, and there are a lot of people who use a lot of the same thing, right? When you think about a black Dube tube, it's a black Dube tube. Everybody freaking uses the same make and model. And so collecting that, aggregating it, and saying, going back to that LP and saying, I actually have, 5,000 of these that I collected across Ontario in the last month. Do you want to buy them? That process, that, sanitized, cleaned Dube tube is cheaper than the new piece because all we've done is collected it from our local environment, usually in GTA, but we're stretching to, bigger parts of Ontario in the collaboration that I'm working on with a company called Friendlier. But all of that can get reused and resold. And the process of of collecting and sanitizing and distributing is lower than the cost of a new piece of plastic. So it's also cost effective.
So would you say, because I know in Canada, they have the bottle deposit system,
yeah,
where that's kind of baked into the price when you buy it at the pub, the liquor store or wherever, and then you collect it all in your garage in big bags, mm-hmm, and you go and take it to, I'm saying this because this doesn't exist in the UK, by the way.
Okay.
You take it all back
so
to the bottle depot,
yeah,
and you hand it over and you'll get 20, 30, 50 bucks, you know, plus, depending on how much stuff you take back. So would you see something, and I guess those facility centers are maybe already set up throughout the country, would that be a potential way for them to do it?
So the difference between the bottle program that you're mentioning and a reuse scheme is that the bottles don't necessarily get reused, they may also get recycled. So, but to the extent of like creating a deposit system, or even, should the regulations allow, a loyalty system with the retailers themselves. So if you bring back a piece of packaging, you get a buck off, right? Of every piece of packaging that you bring is a way to make sure that these customers come back to the retail locations and they're bringing back their packaging. Absolutely. Like there's, even if we don't have an incentive program, as far as the consumers are concerned, it's still cost effective on the LP side.
I know there, I have seen some recycle collection bins in cannabis retail stores.
Yeah.
Is this already happening? Are they already getting reused, or is that?
So many of the recycling programs, and I don't want to paint with a broad brush because I certainly don't know every single recycling program out there. They cost money for the retailers to put in their stores. And then what ends up happening is all of this waste is sent to a private sort of waste management company. And we don't actually know what is getting recycled and what isn't at this waste management company. So we don't know what the level of mismanaged plastics are. We don't know what plastics are even eligible. You know, things may get returned that can't actually be recycled. So we just don't have a lot of visibility into what's happening. And that's my big problem with those programs. On top of the fact that, you know, recycling is not the most efficient system for energy conservation and material conservation, reuses. So when we recycle plastic, there's only a 40% material conservation rate. So that means it takes 2.2 plastic jars to go in for only one to come out. So we're still losing a lot of the material, whereas when we reuse, we have 100% material conservation rate, which means we don't have to go back and extract for more materials in that damaging way.
Mm, wow. I'd almost like to see heavier regulation from the government. By the way, that's a sentence I never thought I'd hear myself say. Heavier regulation on the side of the packaging. Like, why don't they announce themselves as the exclusive distributor of packaging in a centralized place? Everything gets sent back to them. Everyone's using the same packaging. That would be cool.
I would love that, except for they're having a hard enough time managing basic supply chain issues.
Hand that over to the private sector.
That's the thing. And I think that the government involvement in wholesaling in pretty much every province has caused problems for just operations in general, visibility into the supply chain. Like most LPs don't actually know what stores are carrying their product unless they go to that store, look at their menu and see it listed. And that's a problem because all of these government wholesalers are keeping that data close to their chest. They're making logistics difficult. Like retailers don't like working with the OCS. They find it challenging. They don't get their product on time. You know, that eats up a lot of their capital. So there are a lot of things that I would love to change in like the government wholesale system. I wouldn't add packaging onto that list because right now there's a real opportunity for private enterprise to be an active part of this and perhaps set it up in a way that is more efficient from a market perspective, and then go back to these wholesalers and say, we've actually developed a solution that works for business. Like, let's find a way to partner.
Sounds good. One more thing then, I would like to just go through some of the different variations of packaging,
yeah,
that we've seen on the market here, and maybe you can score each one.
Sure, okay.
So
I'll talk about this in the same way that I talked about the, everything is trade-offs. Everything is about trade-offs, not necessarily from profitability, but like The question is, what do you want in terms of your sustainability, you know, moral compass here? So we have three waste streams. We've got landfill, we have recycling, and we have compost. What we know about landfill is that it contributes 8% globally to greenhouse gas emissions, so we want to reduce our impact there. What we know about recycling is that we have a low material conservation rate, and we know that most of the plastics will get mismanaged and not be recycled anyway. And then when it comes to compost, we have a lot of these compostable materials or biodegradable materials that actually end up in landfill, even though they're destined for compost because of user error. So these are kind of like the systems that we're working in. So thinking about, you know, a black plastic jar is probably going to be the worst offender if it's going into the waste stream and not getting reused, because we've got high level of material impact into a landfill. So that's like kind of my worst case scenario. White plastic jar would probably be a little better because at least, you know, 40% of it can be reused in terms of our material conservation rate. So plastic is not a great solution because we're either way, we're losing a lot. Now, Mylar was the big answer to this because it's like it's still plastic, but the grammage, the number, the impact to the waste stream is much lower. A jar is like 30 grams, a Mylar bag is 1.2. Now it can't get recycled, but since most plastic ends up in landfill anyway, it's much lower. Now, do you want to support a material that cannot be recycled at all? So what's the trade-off? Do you know that most of these things end up in landfill, so you're trying to put the lowest contribution you can? Or is the material and the fact that it's not recyclable at all from a sustainability perspective bothersome enough for you to not buy Mylar? Trade-off. What's important to you? Or what, you know, a lot of people are practical. They say, well, most of these things are going into landfill. And that is absolutely empirically true because our waste management systems are not great. Now, aluminum, tin, that is the miracle substance here.
Oh, really?
Because most of the aluminum currently in circulation has been recycled. It is not coming from virgin material. So it has one of the highest material conservation rates out
there. What is the percent, do you know?
75.
Oh, wow. So it's a lot better.
Very high.
So aluminium or aluminum.
Aluminum, that's your British speak popping up again. High material conservation rate, which is great, means that most of the material in use today has not been, you know, virgin mined, which is great from, you know, carbon footprint and a waste impact perspective. So it's excellent. It's a great material. It's harder for people to use, and it is more expensive, typically speaking. And when we think about the child resistant mechanisms that have been mandated, there's a ring of plastic around the rim of the aluminum tin.
So it's like the tuna cans.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and then there's this ring of plastic that makes it child resistant. And if you don't remove that child resistant piece of plastic, none of it gets recycled. Absolutely none of it. So because of the regulations in place and the fact that most consumers aren't aware that they need to separate it, it ends up in landfill.
It's strange to me that we'd have childproof packaging on cannabis, but not on alcohol when, you know, if a kid gets into alcohol, they can die. And I'm not trying to say that it's not a serious issue if a child consumes cannabis. It could most definitely be. I'm not aware of any incidents of death or, you know, as severe as a large quantity of alcohol being consumed.
There isn't, absolutely. There's no empirical proof that it can cause death even in large quantities. So it's uncomfortable. But yeah, there are, and I'll, maybe we can circle back to this or circle back to the packaging, but there are a few things in terms of what the Health Canada mandates, the opacity, the smell proof, and the child resistance that all limit the options in terms of what packaging industry can choose, right? I said this earlier, clear plastic has a higher material conservation rate than any opaque plastic. And so having an opacity requirement means that the industry is by default now less sustainable because we can't use the more sustainable form of plastic. Having a smell-proof requirement means that even things that are created from paper, which hopefully was sustainably harvested from a forestry perspective, means that we're putting saran wrap all over it and adding this additional level of packaging for no reason. And the CR requirement also, as I mentioned with the tin can add this additional level of packaging, which isn't really necessary, but it also limits the suppliers and the materials that we can use, because getting a CR certificate is $30,000. It's expensive. So
what's CR?
Child resistant certification.
Right.
So those are very, very expensive, and not everybody offers them. So even though the packaging may be sustainable, if it's not child resistant certified to a specific level, you can't use it. So we can't use certain materials. We're mandated to add extra levels of packaging, and we're limited in our suppliers and the materials that we can choose based on what has already been certified.
I mean, this has just got to be optics, right? Like, it doesn't seem it's doing any material good.
I don't think any of that makes sense, given that it's all sold in an age-gated environment.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So, like, why are we doing it twice at the end of the day?
And I get maybe, like, at home, but, you know, if you've got kids around, edibles and things like that. But then it's like, well, to your kind of reuse point, you have a child-locked reusable compartment at home that you take the product into. Seems to make a lot more sense.
Just have, than like, a big box at home.
Right.
I this is a weird parallel to draw, but like, when you keep a gun at home, you have a gun safe, or you lock your alcohol bar, right?
Yeah.
So the disparity between what we see in alcohol and what we see in cannabis is quite large, but of course, you know, prohibition for alcohol ended a long time ago, so they've had a lot more time.
It's true. It's a little bit more desensitized throughout society, I suppose, as well. With the tuna cans, and this is just my personal subjective experience, so I don't, you know, there's loads of variables that may be having an effect here, but whenever I seem to buy one of those and open it out, I've always been disappointed with the cannabis. Even when it's looked like good cannabis, the terpenes have been non-existent almost. Do you think that there's an effect of that? Is that something that you've noticed?
It's not something that I've noticed. I have, like, I did see in the few options that I buy outside of my home grow that it tended to be a little dry. So I don't know if that has to do with, like, if they're doing like a nitrogen flush before, which is supposed to preserve a lot of those terpenes and remove the oxygen to prevent degradation. But we do know for a fact that THC does interact with metals, which is why, you know, Canopy had this whole thing with their beverages, because the THC was interacting with the aluminum of the can. So there's definitely something happening there, but it's not in liquid form, which is what the beverages were in, obviously, and so the ability to interact with the material is much larger.
And what was happening there? Was the THC, like, degrading? Was it changing into something?
It was not stable.
Right.
Was the only thing that was published.
Okay.
So that's the only thing I haven't seen the results of that test. Boy, would I love to see that.
Yeah.
But they had to coat the inside of the can, rendering it non-recyclable, to prevent interaction with the THC.
As there's a lot of aluminium cans on the market today, I assume. So I guess they're all just coating it then.
Maybe.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
So that you mentioned the Mylar bags.
Yeah.
So you're saying they were originally thought of something that was going to be great because you can reuse a higher percent of the than traditional plastic, and like black or white plastic?
No. Oh. So with Mylar, the thinking was, like, if most of these things end up in landfill anyway, we want something that has a lower, you know, concrete value. So with a jar, it's 30 grams. With Mylar, it's like 1.2 or 2 grams. So if your mentality is everything's going to end up in landfill, well, yeah, Mylar makes sense. But there's a problem with that thinking in two ways, right? One, Mylar cannot be recycled at all because it's a composite material. And on top of that, like, I want to move towards a world where more things are recycled and more things are reused. So Mylar feels like a step away from that because we're creating a product that can only be destined for landfill.
Can you reuse it or not?
I've never managed to reuse a Mylar bag.
It's a lot thinner, isn't it? It probably doesn't stand up to, like, a rigorous cleaning.
Yeah, it doesn't really stand. And I also haven't, like, found much use for it. Like, I have a lot of jars in my home for sure because I love to give away weed, so I keep my jars and then I give them away to people. Costco jars. I don't know if you've ever bought those, like, marinated artichokes that come in, like, a liter jar.
I know the ones, yeah.
I have, like, 20 of those, and I put my rice in there, I put my flour. It just, like, everything gets reused, and so having something that's Mylar feels like I can't reuse it. It's not getting recycled. I just, the mentality, the ethos behind it is that everything is made for waste anyway, and that's not what we want.
It's changing that mindset, yeah. Right? Yeah, that makes sense. I've had some reports of people kind of saying that a static issue with the Mylar bags can interfere with the trichomes as well. We have put a few buds under the microscope that show very clearly the trichome heads sheared off. They're just like points of trichomes without head. So again, these are living room experiments, you know, nothing scientific.
That's nice.
But I think so. It's good fun. So yeah, who knows if there's stuff going on with that. And then we also have glass jars.
Yeah, so glass has a relatively high material conservation rate in terms of, you know, it's about 60%. So, you know, aluminum is 75, plastic is 40. It's better than plastic for sure. There are all sorts of hidden costs with glass. So when we think about the carbon footprint associated with shipping it, because it's heavier, like that's a cost that we don't necessarily think of. Also, we don't have a reuse system. So, you know, we're not really utilizing it to the best of our ability. But ultimately, glass is a great option when we don't consider the carbon footprint, but we do want to consider the carbon footprint. And in terms of that, reusing glass is also a really great option. A lot of glass is reused. In the U.S., there's a huge system of getting all of these producers in beer to align to specific bottle types that help us achieve, you know, economies of scale in terms of everybody's using the same bottle. We can collect the same bottle. We can clean it. We can sell it to anybody who's been using this bottle, and it's great. But within cannabis, because the marketing opportunities are so limited on the product, nobody wants to have the same jar as somebody else. Mm-hmm. And in order to further collective good. And so, as a result, now also in terms of our Health Canada conversation, the marketing regs and the labeling regs are also causing indirectly a lot of additional waste because nobody wants to be using the same thing, even if that same thing can be more sustainable.
I think that was where my thinking was with the kind of maybe the government should regulate this and they can standardize it all. But to your point, I think, yeah, if you could have maybe a private corporate solution to it that producers or distributors and processors will want to buy into, and you can create the standardization voluntarily through that. That's got to be a better way of doing it.
Absolutely. It's all about making it cost effective. And when I launched this circular master pack, which we're launching in Ontario, it's a reusable master pack. I was thinking about it in terms of like the waste that the industry produced and wanting to address that. But what we ended up coming up with was a 100% post-consumer waste material that was fully branded. And after a single reuse, meaning it was used twice, it was more cost effective than almost the cheapest master pack at 40 cents per use.
And the master pack, that's the big boxes that they stock the individual cannabis SKU items into and send to like the distributor.
To the retailers.
Or to the retailer. Right.
Yeah. So it comes like 6 or 12 or 24. And when a store buys product from the LDB, it comes in those boxes in a master pack.
Okay. So usually that would be cardboard, right?
It would, yes. And so what we've done is added a layer of wax to this cardboard. That wax is still recyclable, by the way, and it doesn't prevent the recycling process once it gets to that point. But the wax helps it be reused between 8 and 20 times. So if you reuse it once, it's already cheaper than a regular master pack. If you reuse it 20 times, like the cost is negligible to your business. So this is one of those situations where a private enterprise develops this solution. As an added bonus side effect of this, we were like, oh, if we're collecting all of these master packs from the retailers, well, we know how much the retailers bought. And we know how quickly they sell through this product. And we know exactly what their address is. And that is information that a lot of these LPs would love to have about their product in terms of its distribution. So not only do we have a product that is utilizing waste products, right? It's made from 100% post-consumer waste, limiting its impact on landfill and recycling. It's cost-effective, and it provides critical sales data. Like, this is a sustainability initiative. It hits all of these boxes.
That's really neat.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Is this available for producers to be using?
It is available, yeah, in Ontario is where we're launching, where we have infrastructure. We're creating partnerships right now in Alberta and British Columbia to be able to implement something similar in these provinces, because it's really all about local infrastructure. We don't want to be shipping things all over the country. But yeah, it's live.
Right on. That's awesome. What is your opinion on, I'm seeing some very interesting innovations with mushrooms and mushroom or mycelium-based packaging. Yeah.
I love it. I think mycelium packaging is really exciting because of how it can contribute to compost. As, you know, when we want to be having more of our packaging that we don't want to reuse, be able to just decompose in our garden. But the best use case for that is where biocontamination is already present. So that's why compostable green bin bags are so important, because there's already a bunch of bio waste. But if we have a product that is not really meant to be in contact with other biomaterials, there's no real need for it to be compostable. And so while compostable packaging represents a really exciting opportunity for a lot of food packaging, it's just not as going to be as effective in cannabis.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Awesome. I got just going, circling back right to the beginning to end it off. What happened with the voiceover dream?
I had to pay my bills. So I taught people how to use software for 3 years. I was like an adult learning instructor. I taught people. I worked for WalkMe. I don't know if you know about them. They went public recently. That was weird to have worked for them like 10 years ago.
Wow.
And then they went public. But yeah, I taught people how to use Salesforce, Workday, just use like technology. It helped me when I was teaching people how to use cannabis. And
it's kind of still voiceover stuff. You know, people listening to the voice.
You know what? Yeah, it is. Yeah. This podcast is voiceover work as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. Would you ever go back to it in the future, do you think?
Sure. If I had like millions of dollars and time on my hands, yeah, I would be a voice actor reading audiobooks. 100%. That's my... Not a movie voice actor. I want to be very clear. I would be reading novels.
Okay. What would be your first novel?
Oh, definitely something dirty, like complete smut.
That's awesome.
that would be my go-to.
Okay, no, I was not. So I was like thinking Harry Potter or something. So that caught me off guard.
I don't have the accent for that. I don't think I could pull it off.
Come on, Jim Dale does a good job.
Does he?
Yeah. I used to listen to the Stephen Fry.
Yeah.
I was the OG, but then I did kind of get into Jim Dale.
Exact.
Stephen Fry?
Yeah.
I think he was the original audiobook. So I had the whole of them on CD. And each CD was like 50 to 60 minutes. And I'd put one on in the evening as a kid. And I'd just be off to sleep by the end of that CD. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't get into Jim Dale until a bit later. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to listen to the whole thing with Jim now.
You have to see if he stands up to Mr. Fry.
It's always difficult getting into a new... get attached.
You definitely get attached to an audiobook voiceover.
Yeah.
And I had one series that I was reading, and they switched actresses mid-series. I was devastated. Devastated.
It's not the same, is it?
It's not. You can never go back.
Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to me today. It's been a really interesting and insightful conversation. Keep me up to date on all the projects that you're working on, because it sounds great.
I definitely will. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Grove Street Journal.